The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at DOUCETSurvey.com. That's DoucetteSurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at NECU.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
In.
3N.
All right.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott.
E.
Two E's.
About 2 years ago, Rene Durrett was on a roll. The Navy reservist from Florida was looking confident, very much in command in her uniform, as she took her turn on the game show Wheel of Fortune.
G.
And there's a G.
The clue she's trying to solve is living things. Three words, one of them hyphenated. After a few good guesses and buying a vowel, she pretty much has the puzzle spelled out.
I got to solve?
Yep.
Seven swans a-swimming.
Yeah, that's... Nothing. Yeah. Can't accept that. Amy, it's your turn.
So at this point, you can hear and see the confusion. The audience obviously thought Rene nailed it. Even Vanna White started to clap when Rene solved the puzzle and then stopped awkwardly. Right away, the next contestant, Amy, swoops in, fills in the rest of the letters, and eventually...
Seven swans a-swimming.
Yeah, that's it. Well, you know what happened there?
No, I thought
you
said that.
Well, Rene knew what happened as well, and it was easy to do because you just kind of did it in the vernacular and left off the G in seven swans a-swimming, and you were pretty clear about that and realized you did that, but that's okay. We still have some time. You have $1,900. You're up over $11,000, so...
In case you didn't catch that, Rene missed out on thousands in cash because she didn't pronounce the G in Seven Swans a-Swimming. In a TV interview the next day, she said, "That's just how I speak. I'm from Florida." We live in a world made up of rules and regulations. Our governments, our religions, our game shows, they all run on rules. And where there are rules, there are technicalities. Those little details that can determine whether a team wins or loses. A guilty person gets acquitted or jailed. Or a politician gets elected, even with fewer votes than their opponent. Whatever the technicality, the very word is often accompanied by a sense of injustice. A feeling that someone got away with something. That playing by the rules was in itself unfair. Here's one that still leaves a bitter taste in the mouths of football fans. It's October 2013. The New York Jets are in overtime against the New England Patriots. The Jets try for a long field goal to win the game, but it misses its mark.
On its way. They yanked it to the left.
Seems like the Patriots are in a pretty good position to win the game. But then...
On the play, unsportsmanlike conduct. Defense, number 94, for pushing the opponent into the pile.
The Jets got a second attempt, made the field goal, and won the game. It happened so fast, many viewers weren't even sure what had happened. The Patriots had violated a new NFL rule, one that had never been called before, and one that didn't make a lot of sense to viewers outside of the league. Pats fans were not happy.
I hated this call. I hate the rule. I don't really like the rule at all. You want to talk about safety and all that? There's a lot of plays that aren't safe. It's football. So the league has to step in
so they should
and make it
rules.
Tougher?
Just have rules on the book that everybody's allowed to ignore. Officials ignore them. Coaches ignore them. Defensive linemen ignore them. It's okay.
But if the Patriots...
We just put it there.
But rules are rules, even when they don't work the way that you want them to. And so from getting away with religious infractions to taking advantage of costly typos, today's show is all about technicalities. We go first to a loophole as big as Yellowstone. Well, almost. It's a technicality that could mean getting away with murder. Brian Kalt is a professor at Michigan State University's College of Law and the man who discovered the so-called zone of death, a 50-square-mile section of Yellowstone National Park in which a person could hypothetically pull off the perfectly non-prosecutable crime. Brian initially wrote about the zone of death in a 2005 article for the Georgetown Law Journal and joins us now with more. Brian, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Loopholes in the law are usually pretty complicated. So can you walk us through this zone of death step by step? What is it about this section of Yellowstone that makes it different than anywhere else in the country?
Well, the key here is that the whole country is divided up into judicial districts. So most states are just one district, the District of New Hampshire. Some states are divided into two or three or more districts. I'm in the Western District of Michigan right now. Every district in the country is either a state or part of a state except for this one. The District of Wyoming is defined as including all of Yellowstone National Park, including those parts of Idaho and Montana that are in the park.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem comes in with the Sixth Amendment. The Sixth Amendment requires a bunch of particular things for criminal defendants. And one of the things that it requires is that the jury in a case be taken from the state and district where the crime was committed.
Uh-huh.
So if you're in the Idaho portion of Yellowstone, you're in the state of Idaho, you're in the District of Wyoming, so the jury has to be from that same state and district. They have to be from the Idaho portion of Yellowstone.
And nobody lives there.
And nobody lives there. Compounding this problem is that because it's part of the national park, the federal government has exclusive jurisdiction. So there is no way for the state authorities to prosecute someone either.
Okay, so you can't form a jury because there's nobody actually in that district. So what happens? The case just gets thrown out on a technicality?
That's my argument. I'm not happy with that conclusion, but I think that the Sixth Amendment requirement is very simple here. Congress, when they set up the district, colored outside the lines, as I put it, and as a result, they make it impossible for a criminal defendant to have his Sixth Amendment rights respected. And we throw all sorts of cases out on more tendentious technicalities than this, things that aren't even in the Constitution, let alone clearly spelled out.
So you called attention to it to point out this loophole, not necessarily to inspire crimes, obviously.
Yes, I gave a talk to a group once about this, and my opening line was that I determined there are two kinds of people who think about how to commit the perfect crime. There are sociopaths who are trying to figure out how to do it, and there are neurotic people who are worried about the sociopaths. And I'm definitely coming at this subject from the neurotic's point of view.
How big is this zone, by the way?
It's about 50 square miles, and there's a similar problem in Montana, which the zone there is somewhat bigger. I call that the almost perfect crime because there are some people that live there, but not very many.
Has anybody since 2005, since you called attention to it, committed a crime here of any type?
Well, not in the Idaho portion. There was a case arising out of the Montana portion. And this was my concern in writing the article. I actually had it accepted for publication in 2004, and I asked them to delay publication until I could get Congress, hopefully, to fix it before the article came out. Congress wasn't particularly interested in acknowledging my existence, let alone fixing the problem. So the article came out, and I was worried about inspiring people. The one case that arose in Montana, though, was not inspired by the article. The defendant poached an elk that was in Yellowstone. He was, again, in the Montana portion. And once the case got going, his lawyer had heard about this, and his lawyer tried to use the defense.
So we're talking about the case of Mike Beldarain. He shot this elk in Montana in December 2005. His lawyer made the argument that he was in the zone of death, couldn't get a jury from that district. So what happened with this case?
So there are two provisions. Actually, there's another one in Article 3 that says the venue of the trial has to be in the state where the crime was committed. So Beldurain's lawyer said two things. One, he was in Cheyenne, Wyoming, before a local jury. So it's hundreds of miles away from where the crime was committed and in a different state. And his lawyer said, first, the trial has to be in Montana. Well, that's not a problem. They could have done that without letting him go free. The second thing he said was the jury has to be from the Montana portion of Yellowstone, which also was technically possible. There are some people who live there. The judge said that while that's what the Sixth Amendment would require, he said to actually do that would create a no man's land. And he said there's no case law that says that he needs to do that. He will dismiss the objection to having a Wyoming jury and proceed with the case. At that point, having lost on that and on some other objections, Beldurain's lawyer then got an offer from the U.S. attorney for a plea deal. And Beldurain pleaded guilty, and the plea deal was conditioned on him not appealing on this issue. He was allowed to appeal on any other issue that he wanted, but they didn't want him appealing this issue to the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals. Now, the U.S. Attorney's Office has sent a signal that they're afraid to have the Tenth Circuit review it. In this case, it involved an elk, and he didn't want to take the chance of going to prison for an even longer term by appealing this issue. But someone with nothing to lose, a murderer, say, would be able to take this all the way to the Tenth Circuit, all the way to the Supreme Court. And this opportunity to close that loophole beforehand was squandered.
So now it's been almost 10 years and still no fixes. Among those who have addressed the zone of death, Idaho Representative Mike Simpson and Senator Mike Enzi. What would it take for this loophole to be closed by the government?
I drafted some simple legislation. It just defines the District of Wyoming as including the state of Wyoming. And then the District of Idaho is Idaho, not Idaho minus Yellowstone. The District of Montana is Montana, not Montana minus Yellowstone. That's all it would take. Of course, saying that's all it would take overlooks how hard it is to get any sort of legislation through Congress, especially lately.
I'm speaking with law professor Brian Kaltz about the so-called zone of death. That's 50 square miles of the Yellowstone National Park, where Brian says a judicial loophole could lead to someone getting away with murder or another crime. He wrote about the loophole in a 2005 article for the Georgetown Law Review, and the idea was later adopted as a plot for a mystery novel called Free Fire by C.J. Box. We've all heard accusations of a do-nothing Congress, but this doesn't really sound like a partisan issue. Why would this be something that would be stalled or not even picked up in Congress?
The main reason that they haven't done anything about it is that they're focused on more important things. There isn't a series of murders in the Idaho portion of Yellowstone that they're responding to. So as long as it remains a theoretical possibility, they're much less likely to do anything about it. When the novel Free Fire came out, Senator Enzi, who's a fan of C.J. Box and of that series of novels, then took an interest in this. And so he approached the Department of Justice, and their response was they didn't think that this would be a problem. They thought they'd be able to get a conviction anyway. They didn't give any legal reason to reach that conclusion. They just made a practical argument. And if you look at the Beldurain case, that is what happened. Practically speaking, they were still able to get a conviction.
I did read that Mike Simpson, he's a Republican from Idaho, congressman from Idaho, still in office. When asked, a spokesperson from his office said, didn't think the zone of death was a problem and argued that we could count on, quote, checks and balances to remedy the issue should a murder be committed. What does that reveal about the respective congressman's understanding of this law?
You know, it's been several years since I read that line, and I still don't know what they meant by checks and balances. I think the idea is the courts will find some way to convict someone anyway. And that's not checks and balances. That's the opposite of checks and balances, right? The court is supposed to protect the Constitution from statutes that violate it. They're not supposed to protect prosecutors from the Constitution. So that was baffling to me. But the first part of that, the checks and balances part, didn't bother me nearly as much as the second part. They said checks and balances would remedy the issue should a murder be committed. If a murder has been convicted, checks and balances, or whatever part of the process you rely on to get this conviction, that doesn't remedy the issue, right? The issue is someone has been murdered, and there's no way to remedy that.
Brian Cald, you're a law professor. How would you advise your students who came to you saying, I found this technicality in the law, this loophole that could allow somebody to get away with something. I'm thinking about publishing something on it. How would you advise them?
Well, I would tell them to not count on Congress or the state authorities, if it's a state loophole, to fall all over themselves to remedy proactively some hypothetical problem. I would tell them to prepare themselves to be blamed if anyone puts their theory into practice. And I would tell them to seriously consider not publishing it until they've at least tried to get it fixed. I published this because, despite the fact that I hadn't gotten it fixed, because I didn't think that someone was so likely to put theory into practice that it was creating a clear and present danger. That said, it does keep me up at night sometimes thinking it's just a matter of time before someone is inspired by this to go out and do this. And I can sort of console myself in the notion that maybe eventually someone else would have discovered it and published it, but that's not really an answer. So if I had it all to do over again, I'm not sure I would publish this.
Brian Cald, thank you for your time.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Brian Cald, a law professor at Michigan State University School of Law. He outlined the zone of death technicality in a 2005 article for the Georgetown Law Journal. It was called The Perfect Crime. Got picked up and turned into a novel. You can read more about it at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, how do you turn on the lights on the Sabbath if you're an Orthodox Jew? Does going to an afternoon Mass on Christmas Eve really count as Christmas Mass? Religious technicalities that keep the observant observant. That's when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and today's show is all about technicalities. Those are the opportunities within rules, if you will. So far, we've talked about a judicial loophole that could be exploited to allow or even lead someone to commit a serious crime. And now we're going to explore some of the many technicalities found in religious laws and doctrine. Father James Martin is editor-at-large of the Jesuit magazine called America and author of The Jesuit Guide to Almost Everything. Father James, welcome to Word of Mouth.
My pleasure.
Well, Father, I have a confession. I guess that's appropriate. I grew up in a Catholic household, and we used to go to Mass in the afternoon on Christmas Eve so we could have Christmas Day free. Were we using a technicality to get out of going to Mass on the actual holiday?
Well, more and more people are doing that. Actually, on Christmas, there's the vigil Mass, you know, which counts for Christmas Day. But a lot of parishes are pushing it back so that the vigil Mass, or, you know, the so-called midnight Mass, is now at 4 p.m. So the midnight Mass is now no longer at midnight.
I like how you say it counts. I mean, that's the way I think we think of it in our mind. Well, this counts as Mass, right?
Yeah, I'm probably betraying a little bit of my kind of cultural heritage too. But, you know, the idea is you want to go to Mass on the holy days. You want to worship the Lord, and you also want to do it in conjunction with the rest of the church. And, you know, the rest of the church is doing it on a particular day at a particular hour. So, you know, thus it does count.
Well, here's one of the areas where I think the faithful often look for technicalities: Lent. So during the Lenten season, first give us the Cliff Notes version of what a proper Lenten observance is.
Well, there are three pillars of Lent: prayer, fasting, and almsgiving. And while most Catholics think it's just about giving up things, you know, it's really about doing things and trying to prepare yourself emotionally and, you know, more importantly, spiritually for Easter. And, you know, really it's around preparing yourself and trying to be good to the community and be generous to the community as a way of preparing yourself for Easter.
So who is required to fast?
All Catholics. I think it's over the age of 12 and under 65. I may be wrong on that, but after a certain period, you're not required to fast. You know, it's fasting on Fridays from meat, and it's also trying to fast in general to prepare yourself. Now, interestingly, at the beginning of this practice, the fasting was done so that you could save money to give the money to the poor.
So the point is not that you can't have meat. I mean, can you have broth or, you know, meat juice or, you know, margarine?
I don't think you can have beef broth, for example. I think that would cross the line. The thing is, you know, not to get too wrapped up in the rules and to use it as a way of reminding yourself that, you know, your body is not, you know, in control of you. That you can refrain from certain things. That it's also a way of being in solidarity with people around the world who don't eat.
We used to look at it so differently. I remember on Sundays we used to think, oh, you can stop giving up chocolate, for example. Chocolate was a famous one for us to give up at Lent. Or in Louisiana, there are churches who hold fish fries on Fridays with fried fish and sides. You know, like these huge parties. Or they'll serve alligator because they're not technically meat. I mean, what do you think when you hear these stories of people just sort of trying to get over?
Well, I'm of two minds. You know, on the one hand, I think, look, people are trying their best. And if they need a break from that, you know, to try their best, fine. On the other hand, you know, I know there are other places, for example, in New York, you know, people ask me all the time, is St. Patrick's Day optional, you know, for fasting? On the other hand, you want to say to some of these people, it's not about rules. And really, if you can't really kind of refrain from eating meat on one day to save money and give to the poor and prepare yourself, you know. So on the one hand, you try to be generous and compassionate to people. On the other hand, you really want to try to kind of urge them to really prepare themselves.
Well, I think this has also changed a lot, hasn't it, in the past, let's say, 50 years, you know, after Vatican II, certainly, or since, when the Catholic Church is, frankly, looking to expand its flock. I mean, is it better for the Church to have fewer hard and fast rules?
Well, I don't think that's the reason behind it. I don't think it's kind of a, you know, way to kind of increase more people coming to masses. I think it's more an understanding after the Second Vatican Council that it's not so much about rules and, you know, following black and white, you know, guidelines, but a way of life. It's more important that you act charitably and lovingly and forgive and, frankly, be kind during Lent than it is giving up chocolate. I mean, when you think about what God wants and what Jesus asks of us, it's not so much to give up chocolate, it's to forgive our neighbor and to be kind to one another. And so, as Jesus says at one point, that's the kind of fast that I want.
Is looking for these loopholes and these technicalities a new phenomenon, or is that just human nature to want to get out of things?
It's human nature. I mean, you have stories in the Gospels where someone comes to Jesus and says, what must I do to gain eternal life? And Jesus tells him all the things and says, and love your neighbor. And the person says, and who is my neighbor? And Jesus tells the story about the Good Samaritan. And, you know, you could read that story as the person saying, well, exactly what do you mean by that? You know, are there any loopholes? And Jesus gives the person no loopholes. It's human nature. And I find myself sometimes sort of lapsing into that. But, you know, it really behooves us to remind ourselves this is about conversion and this is about our hearts and being kind more than it is about following certain rules.
How about the technicalities about getting divorced, of which there are many in the Catholic Church? Do you have to get an annulment?
In order to receive communion, you have to get an annulment. And, in fact, that's one of the things that the Synod of Bishops on the Family was just discussing a few weeks ago. That's a very hot topic and quite complicated. So those the pastoral application of those rules may change, you know, within a year or two. So we'll see what the bishops have to say.
I've always wondered about that, the idea of receiving communion. I mean, wouldn't that be about an intention, an aspiration? I would like to receive the body of Christ, the blood of Christ, as it is in the faith. But you have to do certain things in order to earn that right.
Well, in a sense, everyone has that right or that privilege by virtue of their baptism, basically, and by virtue of participating in the sacraments. But and once again, it's something that's being discussed, you know, right now by the bishops. But basically, the idea is to receive communion. You know, the host, you need to be in communion with the church fully. And currently, under church teaching, someone who is divorced and remarried, and that's and remarried, a divorced person can receive. Is not considered in full communion with the church. Now, there are people who in their consciences, after praying about church teaching and speaking to their pastors, have decided that their conscience allows them to do that. And there are people that I know who are divorced and remarried who present themselves in the communion line. So it's, once again, it's a very complicated topic. And I do hope, though, that the bishops will ease some of these restrictions, because I know there's a lot of pain around that. I know a lot of divorced and remarried Catholics who are really struggling with that.
Well, in the grand scheme of things, are getting over on these technicalities, is this an important thing? Or are these kind of harmless? Is this just what people do?
It's about what helps us get closer to God. Jesus in the Gospels is always railing against people that put rules and laws over the human condition. If following these Lenten practices and giving things up helps you to feel closer to God, fantastic. But I always tell people, if it's something that kind of gets in your way, then don't do it. If the technicalities are burdening you and making you feel like God is kind of a parole officer, you know, or a traffic cop, then move away from it and try to do some sort of other preparation for Lent or for some of these other liturgical seasons.
Father James Martin, editor-at-large of the America, the Jesuit magazine, and author of Jesus, A Pilgrimage. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Well, if you think Catholics have the monopoly on rules, think again.
Hi, I'm Heshy Freed. I'm from San Jose, California.
Heshy is a chef and an avid mountain biker. He's also an Orthodox Jew.
You know, pray three times a day. I keep kosher 100%. You know, my wife wears a wig.
And Heshy is a comedian. We found him through an article he wrote on his website From Satire called The 25 Best Jewish Loopholes. Ask him what it's like to be an Orthodox Jew trying to live in contemporary society, and he will be the first one to tell you it's complicated.
A big thing within Judaism now, a lot of with the organic products, is whether or not you can eat leafy greens, because they contain bugs, and eating a bug is a grave sin. And then there's a debate whether or not eating a full bug or a half a bug or a piece of bug, or is it a winged bug or a regular bug?
In a religion governed by so many ancient rules, many modern Orthodox Jews explore certain loopholes in religious doctrine so they can enjoy some of life's conveniences while still maintaining the faith.
On the Sabbath, Shabbat, Shabbos, whatever you want to call it, there's this law against work. But work is, you know, there's 39 different categories, there's all these subcategories, it becomes probably like, I'd say, 10,000 different things you can't do. Enter the Shabbos guy. The Shabbos guy is a non-Jew who is kind of hired to do things we're not allowed to do on Shabbos. And one of the most common things for them to do is to turn off the fridge light or turn on the air conditioner. Those are the two most common things. But the problem is you can't actually tell them to do it. You have to hint at it. So unless they grew up in a very religious neighborhood, it becomes pretty comical. Then instead of a Shabbos guy, sometimes people will have their kid do it, but they can't really tell their kid. You know, you have these people who will, like, they left the light on in the bedroom. They'll bring a kid into the bedroom. They'll hold the kid up to the light, and they'll stand there for 20 minutes waiting for the kid to randomly hit the light switch.
And then there are the loopholes that don't seem particularly necessary or even very beneficial.
Among the many other things you can't do on a fast day is have caffeine. And for caffeine addicts, I guess this is such a nightmare. Instead of practicing with less coffee, they just go for the suppository. I mean, people who would never, they wouldn't take a suppository if their life depended on it. Fast day comes, caffeine, they're in.
But rules, Heshy says, even the ones he's not exactly sure about, do have a positive effect. All told, like Father Martin, Heshy says that the value comes from engaging with the religious doctrine rather than following it blindly.
What makes Orthodox Judaism such a a joy, I guess, in my life. I mean, if you ask Orthodox Jews what they value most, it's community. And when you're part of a community, sometimes you have to do things that you don't fully understand, you don't necessarily agree with, but it's not necessarily like a negative thing. It forces you to look into things a lot more deeply.
That was Heshy Freed, a chef and comedian who runs the comedy website From Satire. That's F-R-U-M, Satire. There's a link to it at wordofmouthradio.org. Stay with us for technicalities in the creative realm, specifically science fiction. A rabbi compares the complex mythology of the Star Trek universe to the Torah. And a Trekkie explains why the Klingons of yore look different than those of the next generation. Much to explore when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and today we're talking all about technicalities. So far, we've talked about the technicalities that allow for a little wiggle room inside the absolutes of criminal and religious law. Now to the creative realm and to science fiction. Just about every good sci-fi and fantasy franchise comes with a canon of backstories and rules explaining how things work. And just like in the real world, those rules have to be plausible and consistent with the fantasy world that made them. Eric Molinsky is the producer and host of a really terrific new podcast. It's called Imaginary Worlds. In this episode, Eric explores how the many creative minds behind Star Trek have worked to rationalize decades worth of conflicting narratives taking place within the same fictional universe.
Khan, you've got Genesis, but you don't have me.
Probably the most beloved film in the Star Trek franchise is Star Trek II, Wrath of Khan. The characters are, you know, at their best. There's a villain that really gets Kirk's blood boiling.
From hell's heart, I stab at thee.
They're all quoting Moby Dick. It's really great.
I spit my last breath at thee.
But here's the weird thing about Wrath of Khan. Gene Roddenberry, you know, the creator of the Star Trek series, was booted by Paramount before that movie was made. Now, Roddenberry was on the outs because the first Star Trek movie from 1979 was ponderous and confusing, and it was a box office disappointment, and this was supposed to be Paramount's answer to Star Wars. So he was allowed to be a consultant on Star Trek II, although his notes were ignored. And then throughout the 80s, he got more and more upset because he felt Star Trek was becoming militaristic, you know, fitting in with the rest of the Reagan era. Eventually, Paramount let him develop a new show.
I think we shall end up with a fine crew. If we avoid temptation.
So he created The Next Generation. And the tone of the TV show was supposed to be a counterweight to the movies. It was more peaceful, philosophical.
Do you consider yourself superior to us?
I am superior, sir, in many ways. But I would gladly give it up to be human.
When Roddenberry passed away, most people admit Star Trek The Next Generation got better.
Derek McCaw runs the website Fanboy Planet.
He had this mandate that there could be no inter-crew conflict, that they would have moved past that. But even the most diehard fans realize that in storytelling, if everybody's getting along perfectly, then there's no story. It's not interesting. It might be great in a way of saying, that's wonderful, I'd like to believe that we could move to that point, but that's not worth an hour of television.
So this is why I find this so fascinating. We have these huge disagreements among creative people about which direction the Star Trek franchise should go. But for fans, The Wrath of Khan and The Next Generation are all taking place in the same timeline, in the same world. And they're very protective of this timeline, which is called the canon. Now, of course, every fantasy franchise is a canon, but the Star Trek canon is amazingly vast, covering 12 movies, 6 TV shows, including a cartoon show from the 70s, which Star Trek fans argue isn't canon, and all of the novels that were written in between. Even William Shatner, when he was directing Star Trek V, got into an argument with George Takei about the canon and their own characters.
Takei wanted Sulu to get his own command because in the books he had. And he wanted to get his own command in the movies. And Shatner was arguing with him and said, but if you do that, then you can't be in the movies. You're not on the Enterprise anymore.
Actually, even Derek McCaw thought that Shatner was not properly respecting the canon in Star Trek V.
I was really irritated that Kirk never referenced his brother. He talked about having a brother, and he means Spock, but he actually had a brother who was killed in an episode of the TV series. And I was like, I was really mad, but I thought, I get it. For a movie, they can't bog down explaining to an audience who probably haven't watched the series as obsessively as we have to know that, yeah, there was that episode where these little plasma things, these butterflies of flesh, like, you know, went into his back and killed his brother and his nephew with pain. I think the nephew survived. And then they don't reference that family again. So I was bugged that the movies broke that continuity. But most people just kind of went, eh, and accepted it and moved on.
I have mixed feelings about canons in general. On the one hand, they can be very inclusive. If you're a serious fan, you know, you feel like you're part of a community. It's taking this epic ride together. But if a canon is really dense, bogged down with a lot of mythology and exposition, casual fans will just drift away, or they feel like they're not welcome. So in 2009, when J.J. Abrams rebooted Star Trek, I was all for it. I thought, you know, this is great. Let's have this new generation have their own Kirk and their own Spock. And, you know, when I watched the movie, I thought he was being respectful because he sets up that there's this time travel snafu so that everything that has happened in the canon still happened, just in a different timeline. Leonard Nimoy is in the movie to sort of hand the baton to Zachary Quinto, playing Spock as a young man.
Since my customary farewell would appear oddly self-serving, I shall simply say, good luck.
These new movies are really unpopular with Star Trek fans, for a lot of reasons, but the main one being, J.J. Abrams just smashed the canon to pieces. For Derek McCaw, the point of the canon is not script continuity. It's about having faith in the progress of humanity.
One of the things that matters to me about Star Trek is it's a very hopeful vision of the future. Star Wars is a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. That may not be us. Star Trek says, like right now, when I'm scared about where the world is and what's going to happen for my kids, Star Trek tells me, whether it's true or not, because it's fiction, but it tells me that we could work together and we can solve it and we can get past these problems. When the first space shuttle was built, the prototype, I always think it was a mistake on our part as fans to get super excited and say, name the prototype that can't fly the Enterprise. Wait until one can actually go into space and name that the Enterprise. But I can remember, I guess it was 1976, where they rolled it out and they played the Star Trek theme, and it was like, you know, and all the cast was there, and it was like, yes, this is going to happen. We're going to make it.
Over the years, a lot of people have compared sci-fi fandom to religion. Or they'll say the canon for Star Trek or Star Wars is like, you know, the Bible for fans. And they may not be totally wrong about that.
Good afternoon, Har Shalom. This is Gretchen.
Yeah, can I have Rabbi Ben Newman, please?
Sure, just a minute.
Thanks. Ben Newman is a rabbi at Congregation Har Shalom in Colorado.
Hey, Eric, how are you?
Good. Do you have the iPhone out?
All right. Okay.
Ben is also a full-fledged geek. A few days before we talked, he ran a Sunday school class where he broke the students into groups based on Disney properties. Marvel, Muppets, Princesses, and Star Wars.
The Star Wars group used this idea of the Force and being like God. I didn't actually tell them about that, but that's something that I had thought when I was that young too, so it was pretty cool.
So the Old Testament, which Jews call the Torah, is kind of like the original canon. And a long time ago, rabbis started to wonder about the gaps between the stories, what happened to the characters when, you know, they're not appearing in the Torah. And so they started making up their own explanations to fill in these gaps. And those stories are called Midrash, or the plural would be Midrashim.
There's a whole bunch of Midrashim written about Abraham, because the story of Abraham basically begins with Abraham being told by God to leave his home. But it doesn't say anything about his childhood. So they come up with all these stories about Abraham's childhood and how he rebelled against his father.
Oh my God, this is fan fiction.
Oh, totally. Rabbinic Midrash is kind of like fan fiction, right? And they become part of canon, right? And if they feel true enough, if they're good enough, they stick. You know, they become part of the story.
In fact, this is my favorite example of a sci-fi canon acting like a religious canon. It was 1996. Digital effects were still pretty new, and the writers of Star Trek Deep Space Nine realized that they could do a time travel episode where they digitally paste their characters into the original show, so they're standing next to the young Captain Kirk.
I have guards around the Klingons.
I can't believe you don't at least want to meet Captain Kirk.
That's the last thing on my mind.
Oh, come on, Benjamin. Are you telling me you're not the tiniest bit interested in me?
But then they came across a problem, because in the original show, the Klingons just look like people with goatees and heavy eyebrows. And then in the movies and the later TV shows, they got a bigger makeup budget and better technology, and so they gave the Klingons these very alien-looking prosthetic ridges on their foreheads. So how do they explain the difference when these two Klingons from different TV shows and different time periods are standing next to each other?
They are Klingons, and it is a long story.
What happened? Some kind of genetic engineering? A viral mutation?
We do not discuss it with outsiders.
That's Midrash. You know, that's exactly what Midrash is. It's a way of looking at the stories and explaining the discrepancies. Okay, so if it was a biblical story, right, you would say, oh, in Genesis 2, the Klingons had no ridges on their foreheads, but in Genesis 3, they did have ridges on their foreheads. You know, what's the deal?
So why does the Old Testament have so many contradictions and inconsistencies? Well, because it wasn't written by a single person. And this is something that religious scholars agree on.
They identify four distinct authors with different styles and different agendas and different philosophies. Supposedly, according to scholars, they were written at different time periods and they were collected together and probably presented to the Jewish people around 400 BCE.
Now, at this point in history, the Jews are scattered across the Middle East. And there's a movement to bring them back to Israel, to unite them as a culture.
They brought this document, the Torah, to the people, and they read it publicly. Scholars say that's probably when it was first written down, first collected.
So their leaders are basically saying, we have to stick together as a people because these are our stories. They define who we are and what we believe. But the authors of the Torah still disagreed on what the stories meant and what people were supposed to take away from them. Sound familiar?
Each of the different authors has their own kind of formulaic way about them. So, for example, there's one author called the Deuteronomic author, who probably wrote the book of Deuteronomy and several other passages throughout the Torah. And the Deuteronomic author, his whole formula is basically, his or her whole formula is basically, you do good things, you'll be blessed. You do bad things, you'll be cursed. Basically, every time you see that in the Torah, it's an indication that that's probably written by that particular author. The book of Job comes along, and the book of Job basically takes the genre of the Deuteronomic author and smashes it to pieces, and basically says, no, you do good things, and it doesn't necessarily mean that good things are going to happen to you, and you do bad things, and it doesn't necessarily mean that bad things are going to happen to you. And so there is kind of a... there's a response even within the genres. And I think you see that also in you know, modern sci-fi also. At least when you have different directors or whatever, they're responding to each other, responding to their different interpretations of the character.
In 2014... AD, a council of scholars met to decide the fate of another canon. Disney, which of course bought Lucasfilm, is about to crank out a ton of Star Wars sequels and spin-offs. But first they had to grapple with the fact that all these novels had been written that took place after Return of the Jedi, told the story of how Princess Leia and Han Solo got married and had children and etc. So Disney came out with a statement saying that those books are now invalid. None of that stuff happened. We're going to invent a whole new history for these characters when we get to episode 7. And so fans who believe that those stories were in canon are really upset. And J.J. Abrams, amazingly enough, has managed to piss off a group of fans from an entirely different franchise. But this is what we do as humans. We come up with stories, we fall in love with the characters, and then we fight over them. And loving and fighting is what makes a good story.
Producer and host Eric Molinsky from his podcast Imaginary Worlds. You may have heard his work on Word of Mouth or Studio 360 in the past, and the new podcast is really a ton of fun. You'll find a link to it at wordofmouthradio.org. If you're just tuning in, today's show is all about technicalities, a subject that cannot be discussed without talking about language and punctuation. Who knew the perils of an errant apostrophe, a run-on sentence, or a misplaced comma? Few understand the risks of bad grammar like the folks at NASA. Case in point, the Mariner 1. In 1962, programmers working on the Mariner 1, which was the country's first planetary mission, failed to include a single hyphen in the spacecraft's guidance system.
When the hyphen was left out, false information was able to feed into the spacecraft control. And it took a nosedive and totally imploded on takeoff.
And that's Zachary Crockett. He's a writer for Priceonomics. We're going to be hearing more from him in just a minute. As for Mariner 1, the failed mission cost about $80 million in 1962 dollars. Science fiction writer Arthur C. Clarke famously called it the most expensive hyphen in history. NASA was able to recover pretty quickly. Just 5 weeks later, they successfully launched the Mariner 2, probably after a pretty thorough proofread of the program code. To trace the most expensive comma in modern history, you've got to travel back nearly a century earlier, when a legislative technicality cost the U.S. government millions. Here's Zachary Crockett again.
So in 1872, Ulysses S. Grant wanted to kind of bring the economy back on track, so he created the Tariff Act of 1872.
Now, this was back when income taxes were collected only during wartime. Most of the federal revenue back then came from taxing imports on food or textiles and steel and other products.
And one of the stipulations in previous acts was that fruit plants would be on what's called a free list. And a free list was basically items in a tariff act that are exempt from duties.
So here is where the language really starts to matter. Those previous tariff acts all stated that, and I quote, fruit plants, comma, tropical and semi-tropical, end quote, were exempt from duties. So basically, if I wanted to bring a banana tree into the U.S., I wouldn't have to pay for it.
Now, in 1872, in the new tariff act, somehow a comma snuck its way into this tiny little line between the words fruit and plants.
Oops.
So now it read, fruit, comma, plants, tropical and semi-tropical for the purpose of propagation or cultivation. There were thousands of fruit importers, you know, lemons, oranges,
pineapples, grapes,
coconuts,
limes, mangoes,
which usually had a 10 to 20% duty. And now, under this new line with the comma included, they were arguing that their fruits were on this free list and they shouldn't be charged duties.
So these importers had already paid tariffs overseas. Now they were asking the U.S. government to reimburse them. The Secretary of the Treasury at the time rejected their claims outright. His basic argument was, you know, you guys, you know what we mean. Come on.
And the importers got angry and they trusted their grammar. So they took the matter to the courts. And 2 years later, by 1874, it was decided in the importers' favor that the phrasing of the act was ambiguous. And $2 million worth of duties eventually had to be paid back to these importers.
Now, if you think an $80 million rocket was a heavy loss in 1962, remember this was 90 years earlier. Back in 1874, $2 million amounted to 0.65% of the entire federal budget. That same percentage of our federal budget today would be $19.5 billion. So yeah, somebody screwed up big time. And that is how a technicality cost the U.S. government lots and lots of money. If there's one lesson to be learned here, it is that poets can afford to play with grammar. They're already broke. For legislators, it is much cheaper to hire a good proofreader than to make even a small mistake. You'll find a link to Zachary Crockett's article for Priceonomics called The Most Expensive Typo in Legislative History. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you visit our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio, you will find that proper punctuation is not required to get in on the conversation. We'd like to know which technicalities work for you. If you're religiously observant, have you figured out how to skirt the rules? How does it feel to get over on a tax loophole? Do you look for the way out of following rules and regulations? Is it human nature to find the loopholes and ambiguities? Well, let us know what you think on our Facebook page. And with that, we leave you with the old Bob Hope joke. I do benefits for all religions, he said. I'd hate to blow the hereafter on a technicality. I'm Virginia Prescott, hedging my bets. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.